Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the podcast that is always up to speed with Formula One. We have a special presentation for you today. Joining you, as always, is myself, Mr. Mark Hamilton, my co-host, Mr. Mark Daly. But we also have a special, special co-host, Mr. Tim Haraney of TSN and the Racing Pod podcast. We've got a great show for you today. We just finished watching the Monaco Grand Prix. It's a race that doesn't typically have a ton of hype going into it, but boy, was today's race eventful for a number of different reasons. Before we get to it, Mr. Daly, Mr. Haraney, how the heck are you?
Good. I'm really good. I'm pumped up. I mean, not only was it Monaco today, it was the Indy 500. So, I mean, my cup runneth over, which I guess considering the weather in Monaco today is kind of appropriate.
Yeah, me too. I mean, a lot of racing on today, which is awesome. I mean, literally just got done speaking with Marcus Ericsson, who won the Indy 500. I mean, that was a great race. I mean, if we have time at the end, we need to talk about this. I'm definitely talking about it on my podcast, but it was an awesome race. I don't know if you guys caught it all.
Just a little bit. I mean, it's great to see Marcus win. I mean, of course, Marcus raced in Formula One for a number of years, so there's another kind of a cool crossover there, but I'm still trying to catch up on that one. I've gone from Monaco to here, then I'm going to go back and watch whatever I can of Indy, but I think I'm going to run out of time to try and watch all the things I wanted to, because yesterday was Champions League final as well, so I only got caught up on that as well this morning.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was wondering why people across the street were yelling so loud during the day.
Now you know.
Man, and we have the NBA, not to get completely derailed so early in the podcast, because that typically happens with Daly and I, but we're on the cusp of the NBA Finals. And I feel like, Tim, you know, you and I were on a Spaces conversation about 8 months ago on the precipice of the NBA season. And I had predicted the Lakers would be in the finals. That sure didn't happen. But I seem to remember you predicting that the Warriors would be in the finals. And boy, did you nail that one.
Yeah, I did. I got that one, but I think I got the Eastern Conference finals wrong. And I think I also got the team that was coming out of the East wrong as well, because I chose the Milwaukee Bucks, I believe, if our memory serves correctly, but they were eliminated a while ago. So
hilarious. So before we drop off and lose too much of our audience, we should probably pivot back, rotate the back end of this podcast into the turn that is the Monaco Grand Prix. It was an eventful race for a number of different reasons. Before we jump into the race, because there's tons to talk about, we should probably revisit qualifying quickly. For the second year in a row, Charles Leclerc, his home race, qualifies on pole. And for the second year in a row, it wasn't because of, well, I would say it was because of an eventful mishap on the track. Last year, of course, he crashed his car, ended up damaging the gearbox that we didn't know about until the race was about to begin, didn't race at all. This year, approaching the tunnel, Sergio Perez goes into the wall, signs make contact with him, qualifying's over, but not before Charles Leclerc puts in a blistering 1:11.376 to take pole. Gentlemen, any thoughts, any reflections on qualifying this weekend? Because as we know, so often, this is the most important part of a weekend at Monaco.
Yeah, I mean, qualifying, I think, for Monaco is always the most exciting part of the whole weekend in terms of the on-track spectacle, because usually we don't really get a super exciting Grand Prix. But, you know, that being said, we'll obviously break that down in a little minute here. But I think if we just take a look at like how dominant the Ferraris were, not only in qualifying, but also in practice as well. I mean, Charles Leclerc dominated P1, P2. Sergio Perez was quicker than him in P3. And, you know, if you go back to the Spanish Grand Prix, and if we just take a look at that final sector, you know, we can take a look and see that, you know, Ferrari was the fastest in that sector, and Red Bull was second, and Alfa Romeo was third. And usually we kind of use that as a sort of a barometer to kind of measure who will be quick in Monaco. And in Charles Leclerc, I mean, was due for a win at his home race. And so starting off the weekend, you know, he started off super strong. I mean, his pole lap, he was about like 0.3 further ahead of his teammate Carlos Sainz in Q3. I mean, his pole lap was that far. And obviously, yeah, I know that the ending of qualifying did get spoiled because of what happened with Sergio Perez and Carlos Sainz. But I mean, at the end of the day, that's still a monster number, and it's still uber quick. And obviously, it's a shame how it ended for him. But I mean, going into all of this, I mean, I was really excited for him.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Tim, if you look at the Q3 times, Charles's fastest time was 111.376. And then I know we have the disclaimer, of course, that they never really got that last fast lap off because Sergio stuffed it into the wall just before they went into the tunnel there. But it's interesting. You look, Carlos's Q3 time was 111.601. Sergio's was 111.629. And Max's was 111.666. So you got like 6.5 hundredths of a second covering those next three cars. And then you go back to Lando, who qualified P5. His time was 111.849. So, I mean, you drop off another quarter of a second, and then everyone beyond that is already into the 112s. And then Esteban Ocon, who rounded out the top 10, he was already at 113.045. So, I mean, they start to spread out. So, I mean, just that really small delta between Sainz, Perez, and Verstappen is amazing. But then you put into the context that Charles was that much further ahead of them is just incredible.
And even though like Max was doing a push cool push, because I think for him and that soft tire, and what Red Bull started to notice was that, you know, that second push lap on that particular tire for them at this race, they were still able to eke out quite a bit of lap time, because that first sort of initial run is kind of like just scrubbing the tire a bit, which was actually quite interesting, because I didn't really think that there would be much life left in these soft tires after that first run. But with that Red Bull, I mean, they did a really impressive job like keeping that tire alive, and Max going even quicker on his final attempt. And so we don't know where he would have ended up in qualifying, but it's just interesting to note, like, as we start to move forward in this season, and like I've pointed out before, it's like this Red Bull is just really good with its tires.
Oh, amazing. Especially, I mean, we'll get to it eventually, but if you look at how the latter stages of this race developed, is you had both the Red Bulls on the mediums and both Ferraris on the hard tires, and it was interesting how they were actually able to, you know, I guess, protect and preserve those tires, the two Red Bulls. I mean, it didn't really give them a huge advantage over the Ferrari, but I was just wondering, are they going to be able to make this last till the end of the race? But anyhow, getting ahead of myself here a little bit. Mark, back to you, sir.
No, it's all good. And I have a question. So I want to preamble this a little bit, but when I was a kid, I used to always love picking up the newspaper long before the internet, especially during baseball season, pull up the box score. And I'd love to go see who scored an RBI, a home run, what their batting average looked like. And even today with Formula One, I love to grab the race classification, get a sense of how people performed at free practice one and Q1, Q2 and Q3. However, unlike baseball, where the box scores don't really lie, there isn't a lot to unpack from that. In Formula One, there can often be some deception. And Tim, this is a question for you. So I pull up race classification. We all watched. We know Lance didn't get out of Q1. Really disappointing because, of course, Seb got all the way to Q3. Nicholas Latifi, I think he finished 0.6 or a half second off of his teammate, Alex Albon. Given that this is admittedly both Canadian shows, any thoughts or reflections on the struggles that Lance encountered in Q1? Is there something that is deceiving about that Q1 time? Something that should be, I would say, promising or encouraging despite the slow time? Your thoughts on the performance of the Canadian drivers in Q1?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, looking at, for Lance in particular, in that Q, you know, in that Q1 performance of his, I mean, he had a huge moment at swimming pool, like huge. And that was on his final push lap. And then obviously we heard him on the radio, like screaming. And I had every right to, because in all honesty, this B-spec Aston Martin is a good car. Like, I think they've really got something here, guys. And I think he knows for that he had a Q3 car on his hands. He even admitted it after qualifying. And so I think for Lance, you know, this was a tough one because obviously then it goes on to affect his race, you know, as well. Obviously, I mean, with Monaco, it's all about where you qualify to give yourself any chance of getting a good result and scoring some points. I mean, you have to qualify close to that, right? Or in the points. And that's basically how that kind of works out. So, I mean, that's a tough one for Lance. I mean, you can't make mistakes. Like, he can't be making these type of mistakes at this point, right? And I do understand that, yes, this is basically a new car and he's still kind of coming to grips with it. But I mean, he could have scored some really good points this weekend. He really could have. And as for Nicholas, I mean, man, he does not look comfortable sometimes in this car at all. The amount of steering inputs that he has to put into turning the car. I mean, if you look, it's not like one steering input. There's a couple, and you know that could speak to maybe this car needs a. This car could need a new steering rack. It could need a new steering column that benefits him and his driving style. And there's not a lot of downforce on this car either. I mean, it's fast in a straight line, but in terms of cornering and downforce, I mean, it's not there. It doesn't have it. But at the end of the day, I mean, for Nicholas, it's just trying to get that confidence. I mean, when he started the weekend, he was so far off Alex. It wasn't even funny. But once he got to qualifying, it kind of looked like he dialed himself back into it.
So that we know going into the race weekend, going into Sunday, Ferrari then had locked out the front row. They looked to be in a position to score some major points to take a big bite out of Red Bull's lead in the constructors. As you just described a couple of minutes ago, Mr. Daly, Charles Leclerc qualifies on pole, followed closely by Carlos Sainz, Sergio Perez, Max Verstappen, Lando Norris with a beautiful Q3 performance, lands him in the top five, followed by George Russell, Fernando Alonso, Lewis Hamilton, Sebastian Vettel, and Esteban Ocon. Now, moments before this race is ready to take shape, and moments before the pit lane's about to open, we start to see some water spitting down on this track, some dark clouds move in. And despite the fact that the air temperature was 22 degrees and it was a relatively mild 30 degrees on the track itself, the rain clouds opened and we got a torrential downpouring of rain. And immediately, especially on social media within the commentators and the analyst world, there was criticism of how the FIA, the stewards and the race directors ultimately waited almost an hour before they got this race underway. Initially, it was red flag. They eventually got it going. It wasn't a standing start. Tim, from your perspective, were the stewards offside? Were they being cautious correctly? Should they have gotten this race started a little bit earlier?
Yeah, a little bit too cautious. I think that they could have started this thing at its scheduled time. And as the weather got worse, then they could have thought of like red flagging it then. But at the moment when it was scheduled to go, it wasn't that bad. Like the weather was not that bad. And, you know, Martin Brundle always says it best, right? Where he says, you know, the throttle works both ways on and off, right? But that's what we tune in to watch, right? Like we tune in to watch the best drivers in the world compete against each other in all different forms of conditions, right? That's why we watch, and because we want to see the skill. We want to see them dance these cars through torrential downpour and have success or flirt with danger at some points. I mean, that's why we watch. I mean, to watch how skilled these racing drivers are. And so, yeah, I think they should have let this thing go lights out on its scheduled time. Daly, what do you think?
Yeah, totally. I mean, because it became the predictable story of, okay, well, how long are they going to stay on full wets? How soon are they going to go to inters? And are some guys going to go straight from wets to slicks? And how's that going to work? Because it really... changed the strategy and flipped it on its head, because you had guys coming in and then coming in again in a very short amount of time. And I guess ultimately that's what really determined and flipped up the running order with the top four or five cars there, because it got a little bit chaotic. And I mean, once they got racing, I mean, I know they did a couple of formation laps. Once they actually went to racing and the track was green, I mean, it was predictable almost. You could see that dry line starting to form on the track within a couple of laps. I mean, you could see that slightly, that different discoloration where the cars were actually like on the racing line. And then predictably up at the top of the hill, maybe it's a little bit warmer, maybe a little bit more direct sunlight. You could see that dry line probably within about 10 laps. And it wasn't just a little bit damp. It was actually dry pavement up there.
But even if you go back, right, Dale, I mean, if we go back to the start, I mean, even the fact that it was a rolling start is still a little, it's still a little too cautious. I mean, why wasn't this a standing start? I mean, they could have gotten away. They showed that they could get away on the formation lap. So why not a standing start? I mean, you're actually putting more drivers in jeopardy by doing a rolling start, because now you have more speed heading towards T1 instead of doing a standing start where you have less speed heading towards T1. Like, it just doesn't totally make any sense.
Well, you know, that's the conversation we had when we were watching the race at home here this morning, was that, okay, they're going to do a couple of laps. They're going to get their tires up to speed. They're going to go, the safety car is going to go in the pits. They're all going to fly down the straightaway and somebody's going to come to grief at Sandevote there. And we're going to have a big pileup. And then the track's going to be, we're going to be a safety car, a red flag or something like that. But those first couple of laps, I mean, the field was uber cautious going around. I mean, nobody was really pushing it very hard, I think, at least for the first two or three laps that I noticed. Hammy, I don't know if you saw that any differently than I did.
No, I completely agree. And let's be honest, FP1 in a lot of ways was kind of a write-off in and of itself, because these drivers were feeling out this track for the first time in entirely new machinery. And, you know, we've talked with Tim in the past about the fact that one of the downsides of these cars is that they are really challenging to maneuver in sharp, slow, technical corners. And that's all Monaco is. So they kind of worked beyond that in FP1 and FP2. We started seeing them put in some faster laps. And by FP3, they were beginning to get pretty comfortable. But all of a sudden on Sunday, you throw in the rain. And again, they're still not super comfortable with this track. They're rocking it with 18-inch wheels, which means they've got diminished visibility. They're still challenged and struggling to get these big, heavy, oversized Formula One cars. And I know that's a controversial take, but they're struggling to get these big cars moving through these corners. And then all of a sudden you add in all of these moistures and the extreme wet tires, which they haven't really experienced this year. For sure, they're going to be a little bit cautious. But Tim, I agree with your point, and we'll get there in a minute. I was shocked that not only did they not start the race as a standing start, but when it was subsequently red flagged, they didn't do a standing start. They did a rolling start, which was even more shocking to me because, Daly, to your point, the track did dry out pretty quickly. And by that point, it was in a much, 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 much better state. So, Daly, you made a great point, which was the weather ultimately injected some strategy and some pit stop calls into this race that had a very significant impact on the outcome. So we saw Charles Leclerc, fantastic qualifying performance, puts it on pole for the second year in a row. And I was a little bit nervous for him, and I was quite anxious watching those first through laps, because despite the fact that he's got the clear air and he's not dealing with all the spray as every other car on that track was doing, still a little bit anxious, because he was the one that was setting the pace, setting the tempo, feeling out the track. He had no line. He was picking the line. Everybody else was kind of following him, but he started putting in some masterful lap after lap after lap. But the race was then ultimately stolen from him. And it wasn't stolen because of a mistake that he made. It wasn't stolen from him because of a maneuver from another team. It wasn't stolen because there was a crash that backed up the field, but a strategy decision. So Tim, I'm going to flip this one over to you. Ferrari, strategy mistake. Can we even begin to unpack what happened here?
Oh, man, this is a big one, isn't it? I mean, let's take a look at like Ferrari's strategies as a whole since like 2017, when Sebastian Vettel was in contention to win a championship. And lo and behold, some of the races that costed him good positions that would have helped him in that championship push.
Yeah.
Race strategy came down to race strategy, guys. And again, they haven't cleaned up a lot of those little mistakes that they make with race strategy. I mean, take your hat off to Red Bull, because they always seem to get that strategy right, even though if it is risky, right? Because sometimes they do run some risky strategy calls, but it pays off. Totally. Like they always get it to pay off. Where for Ferrari, it's a disaster. They try to roll the dice with some things, and it just literally blows up in their face. And it sucks if you're a Ferrari fan, and it sucks if like you're a Charles Leclerc fan. And they dropped the ball on Sunday in Monaco. Bringing Charles Leclerc in was not the call, right? They did the right thing in what Carlos Sainz wanted to do. He dictated what he wanted, right? He stayed out until there was a clear, dry line. And he stayed out and he pushed that envelope to get to those slick tires, which not a lot of drivers did. There were some, but there weren't a lot. But for Carlos Sainz to do that, he actually did put himself in a position to win. There was some slow traffic on his outlap that can be argued that costed him getting into the lead of the race, right? Like it could have. There's an argument there for it. But then bringing Charles Leclerc in, like it just didn't make any sense. Like, why are you trying to double stack? Like, you don't need to do that at that moment, right? I am not a race strategist, but even I knew at that moment, like.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
What the hell are you doing?
You know, it's funny, Tim, when you were saying you're making those comparisons to Ferrari over the years, I said my first reaction was, dude, how far back in time do you want to go with this one?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, if you look at like the top three teams, I don't think there's any debate here when it comes to the power rankings on strategy. It's Red Bull, Mercedes, and Ferrari. Red Bull gets it right pretty much all of the time, although some of those calls, like Tim said, are risky.
Agreed. Totally
Mercedes
agreed.
Is not afraid to make those risky calls, but it hasn't always worked out when they needed to. And then Ferrari, just as we saw today, they sometimes do it, sometimes it works, but there's way too many times we're sitting there scratching our heads and throwing our hands up in the air in a WTF moment, right? And that's what we saw again today, because I mean, his reaction, I think, was pretty much everybody else's, that regardless if you're a Ferrari fan or Charles Leclerc fan or not, I mean, if you just kind of look at the situation, see where he was and where he ended up, I mean, screaming with frustration into the radio was the correct reaction from Charles Leclerc. And then at the end of the race, when, and my wife made the great point when his engineer said, Charles, that's P4, she's like, why the hell did he need to tell him that? Because he's been behind Max, he's been behind Carlos, and he's been behind Checo for an hour and a half. He knows where he is and he's not been happy about it. And Charles, he says, no words. I mean, what else do you see? Yeah.
And just to reinforce that as well, not only was it not necessary to remind him of his final classification, but to do it at a race that he was leading in his home city is appalling. And for those of you listening at home that maybe didn't see the race or weren't totally clear on what happened, I'll quickly just recap this because we put it in the show notes. Thanks to our friends on Reddit for helping us put this together. On lap 16, Ferrari agreed to keep Carlos Sainz out with a plan to bring him in later for slicks. They had originally told him to come in for interest. He said, no, 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 I'll wait for slicks. Red Bull then pitted both their inters for both of their drivers for inters. So Ferrari asked Sainz to box for inters on lap 18. Sainz refused again. So for two consecutive times, he refused to go into inters, wanting to stay out for the slicks. He refused, indicating he wanted to stay out until he could get onto slicks. But then suddenly the team asked Leclerc to come in for inters. So at this point, Sainz has already refused twice, indicating I want to stay out for slicks. They asked Leclerc to come in. As the race leader, he does. So he goes in, despite the fact that their strategists and the engineers and the team know that it's not necessarily the right move because they've already decided not to do that for Sainz. So they then bring Leclerc for intermediates, but then they almost immediately bring him back within three laps for slicks. But they do so the moment they brought in Sainz. So it's almost like it was an unintentional double stack. And what we heard on the race radio was Charles Leclerc screaming at his engineer, bleep, bleep, what are you doing? And moments before that, his engineer was on the radio telling him to abort that pit stop. So they'd asked him to come in, asked him to abort, but at that point, he'd already made the turn into the pit lane. So now he's approaching the box, surprised to see Carlos Sainz in the box in front of him. So now he's losing valuable time sitting there. He lost valuable time because he pitted for inters three laps before when the team knew that wasn't the right strategy decision. So Sainz goes out, gets stuck behind Mr. Latifi. Leclerc goes out. He loses first place, second place, third place, and fourth place. Pretty atrocious.
You know, it's interesting. I mean, you put in the notes, Mark, that the weather didn't have a factor in determining the outcome of the race, but indirectly it did because we had that hour Absolutely. And 10-minute delay, and then ultimately the two-hour time limit comes into play. But because we had that delay and then the rolling start and the multiple formation laps behind the safety car and all that, we didn't really have the evolution of a typical wet race, right? Where you're always going to get like 90% of the field's going to start on full wets. You're going to get a couple of guys that are a little bit brave are going to go on to inters, and then they're going to try a couple laps and then decide, okay, I'm going to stick with it because they're working, or I got to go full wets. And then usually what happens is one really brave soul who's running in P18 or P19 goes in for slicks, and then everybody kind of makes a judgment call on that. And then today we kind of sort of saw that a little bit, but then to me it felt like it was a little bit of a game of chicken at the front between the Red Bulls and Ferrari as to who was going to blink first to either go from wets to inters or try and extend and go on to full dry tires. And it was interesting. And then it just kind of goes back to that conversation that we had when it came down to strategy. And Red Bull, I mean, they were bold once again, and it worked out. I mean, their stops were pretty on point. I mean, around the 2.5 second mark. And then Ferrari just kind of a cascading, rolling, yeah, mess, a hot mess. I mean, not so much for Carlos, but I mean, you got to give Carlos credit because he kind of made that bold call in the car from the cockpit saying, you know, I'm going to extend, I'm going to keep out, and we're going to full slick tires. So I thought it was a great move, and it paid off for him in the end.
Good on Charles Leclerc for not throwing his team completely under the bus, which he could have, right? I mean, let's face it. I mean, he could have. He threw them right under the bus.
Yeah.
But he didn't. And I mean, I think at that moment, you know, that's a sign of a very mature driver. And a driver who's fighting for a championship. And I think like he knows that obviously he didn't get that Monaco Grand Prix win that he's so desperately wanted, but he's still in contention for this championship. He still needs to keep the team together. He still needs to motivate them. He still needs to make sure he's putting in the performances that is required to either keep that gap to a minimum to Max in the championship or overtake him in the championship. Right. And so I think like for Charles Leclerc, I think at the end of this race, he said the right things. He did the right things. And yeah, it's just, you got to feel so bad for this guy, man. Like I just like, God, 2018, what, he doesn't finish. 2019, doesn't finish. 2021, doesn't even start. On pole, doesn't even start. And then doing the classics a few weeks ago, bins like a legendary Ferrari, like just bins it. Obviously, wasn't totally his fault, but doesn't have the luck here, guys.
Well, you know, I mean, you make a great point there, Tim. I mean, it shows a lot of maturity from Charles, because, I mean, he could have come out and said almost anything that he wanted to, like, throw them under the bus, like you say. And I don't think anybody out there in F1 fandom would have disagreed with that. But he's only, let's put it into perspective, he's only 9 points behind Max in the championship. Max has 125 points. Charles has 116 points. We have, what, like 17 races to go or 16 races to go, something like that. There's a lot of racing left to be done. And I think Charles is looking at the big picture, and as much as he would love to have this jewel in the crown, win at Monaco, or at least get a good result in his home race, I think he'll take that in the short term, but ultimately win this one, I mean, is obviously the one that he wants for himself. But I think he just keeps a little bit cool, and well, at least he completed the race. I mean,
so,
yeah.
So after that notorious lap 22 pit stop, we have a race order of Sergio Perez, Carlos Sainz, Max Verstappen, and Charles Leclerc. Now, just five laps later on lap 27, entering into the swimming pool complex, following behind an Alfa Romeo, Mick Schumacher has a very, very ugly crash. And we typically know it's an ugly crash because the race director will cut away and you won't see it until they're comfortable and confident that the driver's okay. So we had a few very scary moments where we know Mick had crashed. We saw a momentary glimpse of the car in pieces, and then they cut away. Fortunately, Mick was okay. He was able to walk away. He collided with the Tech Pro barriers that were, I would say, appropriately positioned in that complex, in that position, managed to absorb a lot of the impact. The car was torn apart, which obviously isn't ideal for a team like Haas that has operated on an absolute budget. It's understood they don't have a ton of replacement parts. They're going to be absolutely stretched thin getting a car ready for Baku in a couple of weeks. Tim, from your perspective, scary, scary crash. Were you surprised to see the rear half of that car disentangle so quickly?
Oh yeah, big time. That was a huge impact. I mean, just the way the car disintegrated, how it came apart, massive. Hearing from Mick after the race, he had said that he got it a bit wrong in the swimming pool, and it wasn't actually the braking or the engine braking. He actually was just offline. He said by about 10 centimeters, he said it wasn't much, and it was just enough for him to lose grip. He said that's how easy it was, and he was off and into the wall, and there wasn't much he could do to kind of bring it back, obviously. But I mean, credit that they put the Tech Pro barrier where they put it, credit the safety of Formula One and the safety and within racing, because that could have been a lot worse.
Oh, totally. Yeah. I mean, it was a scary moment, like you guys say, but I thought it was interesting too, because I think it was mentioned on the broadcast that after Grosjean had that nasty accident in Bahrain a couple of years ago, that they did a redesign that the rear portion of the car is supposed to break off. Yeah. So, I mean, in that sense, it did what it was supposed to do. And then when you saw it get hoisted up off of the track, out of the barriers there, you saw that the front wheels and suspension had broken away. I mean, the one thing that probably was to mix a benefit, at least for the outcome of that crash, was that because he probably did a couple of 360s before he hit the Tech Pro barrier, was he was able to scrub off a fair amount of speed. But I mean, that's two pretty scary crashes that he's had this year. I mean, first he had it in Saudi several weeks ago, and now this week in Monaco. And like Hammy was just saying, they don't have a ton of parts to go to Baku in a couple of weeks. So this is a team that's hurting, because I mean, they started so strong, and not only did Mick not finish today, K-Mag didn't finish today as well, and which was, you know, I don't even know what the reason was, but I didn't even notice that he was out of the race until they were showing some of the replays of Mick's big accident there, and you see K-Mag walking up and down there in the pit lane. I'm like, what the hell is he doing out of his car? I didn't even realize he'd retired.
Yeah, Magnussen was pulled out of the race for a power unit issue that he was faced with during the race, but if we look at it, I mean, like Haas, Günther Steiner explained last week that they wouldn't be bringing like a serious upgrade until probably around France for their car. And when you have crashes like this, and what a lot of us are learning now is that, you know, you can't crash these cars. You can't do it. There's not enough spare parts. These teams haven't made enough spare equipment for these new race cars under these new regulations. And so what's happening is that whenever these drivers are crashing, it's actually stalling their development race. And it's actually putting them behind the eight ball because they have to push out more parts. I mean, I was speaking with Mike Crack about this, team principal at Aston Martin a few weeks ago, and Lance had a crash in Australia. So did Seb. It was an expensive weekend for them as a team. And they had their factory working like 24/7 just to try and get parts to that car, but also get parts ready for this B-spec car that Aston Martin had. And they didn't even know if they were going to make their deadlines. Like it was
crazy. Nip
and tuck whether or not they were going to make the deadlines. And so a crash like this for Haas is a serious thing. It's going to set them, it will set them back. Now, whether or not it'll interfere with upgrades that they have coming for I believe it's France. I mean, who knows? It's hard to say, but it could. I mean, it could. This is not a huge team we're talking about here, guys. Like, and for Mick as a driver, finally starting to get his confidence back after what happened in Saudi Arabia, and just has another massive impact. Like, bins the car. Like, the thing is tubbed for sure. It's got to be.
Yeah.
And so I think for Mick as a driver of this season, I mean, it's been tough, guys. I mean, it has not been a great season for Mick Schumacher. I would just say, I literally would say he's had two good races this season. One of them was a bit of Miami, and the other one being in Spain. And I only say that because he was getting closer to K-Mag in terms of the lap delta.
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting. Yeah, sorry, Hammy. I was just going to say, I think it's interesting, too, because I'll just say this real quick, because I think Gunther was saying after the race that, basically in a couple of one-liners that we'll have to see where we go from here with Mick. I mean, just to sort of paraphrase. So, you know, there's a couple of guys that seem to be on the hot seat now for, you know, where they're going to be and next year. And we just talked about it within the last couple of weeks on our own pod here that, Mick's, is he one of those guys that's in that conversation? I think, it's becoming more and more apparent that he is. I think Ricardo is. I mean, anytime that those conversations or comments come out from your team principal that, we have mechanisms to get out of a deal and so does he, and the expectations aren't being met on both sides. Once those sort of comments start being thrown out there by a team principal, regardless who the driver is, the sort of, I guess, the internal possibilities to motivate and solve things kind of becomes, I wouldn't say desperation, but when it comes to the public thing, I almost wonder if it's a bit of strategy as well. If I can't motivate this dude to do what he needs to do, privately, maybe publicly will maybe motivate him by fear to get his job done, or maybe not. So I think Mick's going to be on the hot seat, and there's a couple other guys there. I mean, can pull off probably three or four names without too much effort here, guys.
Haley, the only thing I would add to that, and I agree with everything you just said there, is boy, has the narrative on Mick Schumacher changed quickly. You know, it was 12 months ago that we were openly talking about how quickly Ferrari would find a way to graduate him into the senior team. And I think the conversation now is based on his performances in the back half of last year, and with a couple of exceptions this year, the entirety of the season, what is he going to need to do to keep a seat in Formula One, period? And just kind of reinforce the struggles that Haas has had. Obviously, they had that beautiful surprise fifth place finish by K-Mag in the opener in Bahrain. In the last five races, they've had 1 points finished. They've scored 2 points. So the season that seems so optimistic and so positive for this team has certainly gone downhill. And just to build on something that you said, Tim, as well, it's not just a matter of capacity with those factories, right? Which, hey, we're going to have to delay some upgrades because we've got to rebuild the gearbox. It's a matter of, we have $140 million to spend this year. If we have to keep rebuilding our existing spec cars, maybe we just can't deploy any upgrades because we don't have the capital left in the budget to allow us to do that.
And that's a cap. That's a cap that's getting quickly eaten into because of escalation for everything. Inflation total, yep, over everything. I mean, Total Wolf talked about it on our media call with him on Saturday, of just about how like the teams need them to kind of increase the budget cap for the season because of all of the inflation that's been going on and freight and how much it's actually costing them to ship everything around now. And so, you go to a team like Haas, I mean, their budget's probably not that huge. I highly doubt they're getting close to 130 million. Guys, I really doubt it. And so now you have a car that, Schumacher's written off. Like, that car is going straight to the dumpster. I mean, and And I don't mean to sit here and bash on Mick. I mean, I just,
but no, it's true.
He's extremely talented.
There's nothing coming out of that car. It's a write-off, like you say.
Absolutely not. Yeah. 100%. It's a paperweight. And so I think at the end of the day, I think, like, I mean, for Mick as a driver, he's always started slow and gotten fast, but he's also never had a teammate like Kevin Magnussen. I mean, who was, you know, his teammate last season is Nikita Mazepin. I mean, and Mazepin's, you know, they're learning as well at the same time. And, you know, Mick's getting his confidence boosted by, you know, beating up on him for sure. Right. So, and then in comes Kevin Magnussen and literally blows the doors off of him in round one. Like, Magnussen was on another planet. Right. And unfortunately for Mick, it just takes him that, just that little bit longer. And he's not the only driver, like you said, Daly. I mean, there are like other drivers that are really struggling with these new regulations. And I think, like, you just, all you have to do is just take a look at the lap deltas between teammates after sessions and just seeing that gap and seeing, you can literally see it, like who all these drivers are. And it's the same group every single weekend, wherever we go. Sometimes there's, it switches just a tiny bit, but not really. And that being said, like, that is a clear sign that some of these drivers are struggling with the regulation, figuring out their driving style for it and getting the car dialed into something that they're comfortable with. And everybody would be like, well, they're Formula One drivers. Oh, they should figure out. But well, the thing is that they can't go and they can't go and push these cars like a lot. They can't go and put these cars on the limit because if they destroy the cars, it ruins the development. And so these drivers are having to like tiptoe around and try to sort of push to that limit. Like, they can't automatically go to it because they know if they destroy the car, it's set the whole team back. So it's a really difficult learning phase for a lot of these drivers. And yeah, I mean, it's tough. It's really tough.
We foreshadowed earlier in the podcast that this would result in a red flag. It did result in a red flag. Everyone's back to the pits. And then the surprise outcome was, you know, I'm sitting there as a viewer thinking, look, without this red flag, without a safety car, we're probably going to see a possession for the rest of the race. It's going to be close amongst the top four, but it's very unlikely that unless one of those drivers makes a mistake or there's a subsequent pit stop issue, we're likely going to see those four race leaders finish in that order. Surprisingly to everyone, the stewards, the race director decide they're going to have a rolling start. It's not going to be a standing start. The race gets underway. And then from the top four upwards, we see very little or no movement until the end of the race, ultimately. Obviously, and we won't have time to get into it now necessarily, but there was a little bit of noise about the fact that Fernando Alonso was going at an excruciatingly low pace, trying to keep as much life into those medium tires as possible so he could get to the end of the race. Upset pretty much everyone behind him from eight down the order.
Yeah, but why, please. Right? No, this is my thing. Is like, why would Fernando just move out of the way? Like,
exactly.
He's driving a race car. Yep. He's friggin' competing. Why is he just going to move? Like, I get like, yep, people get upset, like, but he's not just going to be like, oh, you take it, Lewis. I don't want this points paying position. Like,
yeah.
What do you think he's going to do?
Yeah. It's a ridiculous argument. Meaning Fernando's got two responsibilities. The first responsibility is to bring his car home in the best position possible and take those points or whatever it is. And then his second responsibility is for the benefit of the team and, you know, help his teammate out if he needs to. He doesn't have to like go faster or let Lewis Hamilton by or let Danny Ricciardo by or Sebastian Vettel by just because he's trying to preserve their tires. I mean, that's if he does, he's not doing his job. I mean, if I was a team principal and I had driver come back and say, oh, my tires were going off, I thought it'd be just better to let Lewis pass because he was faster than me. You know, I'd be like, dude, you shouldn't even be here if that's your mentality. So I thought
he
that
wouldn't
was
a, be there. Yeah. He would be let go. He would be fired immediately.
Totally.
Like, they would replace him with Oscar Piastri. That's how that would go.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Listen, I wasn't trying to skip over this topic because I'm member number 347 of the Lewis Hamilton Fan Club of British Columbia and Greater Vancouver. I promise you that. But I would add this. His pace was significantly slower than it probably shouldn't have been. And he couldn't have afforded to do that on any other track in the calendar because he would have been overtaken. The unique circumstances of this track enabled him to carry that pace. But of course, you're not going to move over for Lewis Hamilton, who's one of his absolute mortal enemies on this planet. And maybe mortal enemies is a little bit strong, but they are fierce.
It's not too
fierce
far off of it.
Yeah, they're competitors, man. They're competitors.
Yeah.
So Daly, I was just going to say, I know we've got to wrap this one up. We get the safety car, lap 27, red flag, race restarts. Ultimately, we don't see a ton of movement in the championship order, the race classification. Maybe you want to take us down the final race classification, because the driver who ultimately won this has not had a lot of mention so far and probably deserves some flowers for being able to wrap this one up.
Well, totally. Was Checo Perez wins this one, being the first Mexican driver to win at Monaco in the history of Formula One. And now he's the most successful Mexican Formula One driver ever, which is amazing and a phenomenal achievement for him. And he's totally pumped about it. And you can tell because his tires were starting to go off towards the end of the race. I mean, we got some of those super slow-mo shots of Checo's front tires. They were starting to grain a little bit. And in those last several laps, I mean, if we didn't have that that two-hour time limit coming into effect, I mean, Carlos could have had a real opportunity to make a run at him and maybe pass him. I mean, Carlos was complaining afterwards that when they came to lap Nick Latifi coming into Rascas, or come through the pool and then coming to Rascas, I mean, Nick was kind of like in the wrong place. I'm like, Nicky, move out of the way. And I think he tried to as best he could. And Carlos felt that impacted any opportunity he might have to make a move on Checo. But I think that maybe Charles was maybe impacted most of all, but they were really kind of compressed there towards the end. But Sergio hung on, and I think it's a great result for him. And then I think as a sort of a footnote to all of this, because I mean, if you go down through the final race classification, you have Checo winning, Carlos Sainz coming in P2, Max Verstappen, I wouldn't say in an anonymous P3, but by Max's standards was a fairly quiet afternoon. I mean, he did what he needed to do, and he didn't really have to fight off everyone. Was obviously didn't really get enough to really push Carlos. Charles, as we mentioned, came home P4. Fifth and sixth was George Russell for Mercedes, and Lando, who kind of came out of nowhere and really closed up on George in those last several laps. Fernando, seventh. Lewis, eighth. Ninth was Valtteri Bottas for Alfa Romeo, which was another good outing for him. And then Sebastian Vettel bringing home the Aston Martin for a single point, which I think was pretty well deserved for him, considering he got the car into Q3 on a notoriously difficult track. And then on the driver's standings, we have, as we mentioned earlier, Max is still on top with 125 points. Charles with 116 points in second. Sergio's third with 110. So that's pretty tight up at the top there, boys. I mean, if Sergio can close that gap between himself and Max a little bit, I mean, there's only 15 points between them, then I think it makes it kind of a really interesting to see where this whole Red Bull discussion on team orders goes. Then you have George Russell in fourth, Carlos Sainz in fifth. There's only a point between Carlos and George now. And then Lewis, he's about 33 points behind Carlos Sainz, sixth in the world championship. So that's a big gap there. Constructor side is Red Bull on top with 235, Ferrari second with 199, Mercedes third, 134 points. Then McLaren with fourth, 59, and then Alfa Romeo rounding out the top five with 41 points. So it's looking pretty interesting. And before we wrap it up, guys, I just wanted to just throw this one out here for this discussion. There was during the race there after Max's pit stop, we never really got a good view of it other than the in-car camera. And then subsequently, Ferrari protested that Max drove over the painted line at the pit lane exit there. like I say, we didn't get a really good definitive view. It looked like from the in-car camera, he did cross over that line. Ferrari protested it after the race. I couldn't help but feeling that it was a bit of a makeup to try and see if they could get anything, you know, help Charles out after that blunder in the pit stops. But I think there was a little bit of something to it. And I was thinking that it was a bit strange because considering every single corner on every single Formula One track has like 89 cameras at it or pointed at it, that we didn't get a better view of that incident. Tim, what did you make of that, that whole ordeal? Well, ordeal incident. Let's call it an incident. Let's go with that.
Yeah. I mean, like Matteo Binotto said it best, I guess, during that Sky Sports interview. You know, I get the FIA notifications to my email, and there's a lot of them. But in the race director's notes, it actually does say like has to stay to the right. And so I understand that he was looking for clarification from it. But you know, reading the statement afterwards when the race stewards, the teams met, they all agreed that, you know, the Red Bulls did stay to the right of the yellow line. There wasn't any conclusion that stated that they actually were over the yellow line. They were on it. They weren't over it, though. And so there again, right, with that massive rule book that we always kind of talk about, right? It's all this gray area in it where it's like, well, he wasn't all the way to the right of the yellow line. Yeah, but he wasn't all the way to the left of it either. So right. So that's like again. So I mean, at the end of the day, that's basically what it had said. But yeah, I mean, if you're Ferrari, I mean, you got to try, right? You got to try whatever you can.
Totally. Because I mean, if they give Max like a 5-second time penalty, then Charles gets onto the podium and then, you know, he's slightly less angry this evening than he was, you know, at least he's on the podium at that point. It's not the top step, but, you know, he's still top three, which is maybe better than nothing. So anyhow. And
one last thing just about Nicholas Latifi during that formation lap. He had said that something actually went wrong with the throttle pedal. It actually was on when he was going into the hairpin, and that's why he went straight on. Because obviously, when you're braking and the throttle pedal is active, you get a ton of understeer, and that's literally what happened to him. So so everyone knows that. I'm starting to look at my notes here. Some of the drivers I heard from afterwards. I mean, but Esteban Ocon. Oh yeah, okay. I know you got to take off, Daly, but Hamilton and Ocon, racing incidents, or did that deserve a penalty?
I didn't think it deserved a penalty because I thought that Lewis was behind him and I thought that he wasn't even alongside him trying to go into Saint-Devot there. So I thought, well, why is he getting, you know, why is Esteban getting, you know, penalized for that? I thought it was more of a racing incident than causing an accident. And then when I saw that it came up from the race director that it was being investigated, I thought, well, that seems a little bit harsh. I thought maybe yes. It was one of those incidents that should have been like noted or whatever the vernacular is by the race stewards. I was just like, investigated for what? I don't, Hammy, what do you think?
I agree. I just had to make sure my mic was turned on there. But I completely agree. I had the same sensation when the notification came up on the broadcast. I'm like, what are they investigating here? And I get it that I think the stewards, the race directors this year, feel, especially in the shadow of last year, that they need to be by the book and that they need to investigate things and they need to be clear and transparent. But I thought that was pretty clearly a racing incident. I totally agree. Totally.
I mean, they're setting a sort of a dangerous precedent, guys. I mean, like, now, anything, like, I mean, Lewis wasn't, like, right beside him going into the corner.
Yeah, well, exactly. Wasn't. No, he wasn't. I mean, he was alongside his right rear tire, and he clipped his front wing because of it, and, yeah, it seemed pretty...
And whenever in racing, do you ever see that, right? Like, in racing, it is known, like, as a driver, that if the guy is right beside you, then yes, okay, and you guys make contact, then sure enough. But if he's in your blind spot or if he's behind you, it's your corner, man. Like it is your, like that was, it's Esteban Ocon's corner. Like I don't, like there are some things here that I just like, they're treading a thin line here for other teams for something similar to happen later on this season to bring this up. right? And it could impact Lewis later. You know what I mean? Like, we don't know. So it's kind of like you're starting to set these precedents again. And it's like, come on, right? I don't know. I still like to see drivers solve it for themselves out on the track and not have the stewards get involved. But yeah, that's going to be an interesting one. Shout out to Lando Norris. That guy's still trying to recover from tonsillitis. And he's not 100%, he said. Heard from him on Saturday. But one hell of a performance in qualifying. Guys, one hell of a performance. I think it was only a few tenths off of Sainz in second. Like, it was only a couple tenths. Like, really great job from him. And I thought, yeah, he drove a hell of a race. Same with George Russell. He was,
absolutely, yeah.
He was pretty awesome today as well. Yeah. George Russell, again, getting in the top five.
Well, they're kind of in a bit of funny sort of netherworld almost. I mean, they obviously weren't as quick as the top four, but they were, I mean, obviously behind them was Fernando Alonso that was, adequately holding up the rest of the field, but they're kind of all by themselves. But still, when they told Lando to speed up at the end there and try and have a go at George, I was surprised how quickly he closed that gap, because he was 4 or 5 seconds behind. Then all of a sudden, I think he finished like a quarter second behind George at the end. I mean, ultimately, obviously he didn't pass him, but the fact that he closed that gap so quickly was like, oh my gosh, how much did he have left in the tank? That was amazing. That was pretty cool.
The dark side of Lando's performance in qualifying and during the Grand Prix, once again, is it helps to illustrate how much Daniel Ricciardo has struggled this year. And I think all of us are big fans of Daniel, the personality, the charisma, the energy, absolutely, everything that he brings to Formula One on and off the track. Everything off the track is still there, but unfortunately, the on-track performance has been really, really poor this year, qualifying, practice, and the race. He did move up one position this race. He ended up in P13, but again, not a great outcome for him, especially given the fact that his teammate was fighting for P5 for most of this race. So,
totally. Tim.
Yeah, just one more thing. Sorry about that. You know, you make a great point. And one of the things that I'm starting to notice, and we can use Daniel Ricciardo as an example, same with Sergio Perez, is that these cars are really starting to favor drivers who are like really smooth. Mm-hmm. And there is for those who don't know, there is a huge difference in driving styles between being smooth, aggressive, hustling the braking zones or hustling the corner entry, all that kind of stuff. And for the drivers who are like silky smooth, like, you know, the Jensen Buttons, Sergio Perez is another one, because everyone's always like, they call him the tire whisperer. Well, there's a reason why, right? He's not hard on the tire. That means he's smooth with the car, right? He doesn't really aggressively drill the brakes into the braking zone. He doesn't aggressively mash on the throttle as he's leaving, you know, the corner. He's really smooth with how his steering inputs on corner entry to apex, good with min speed as well. And, you know, a lot of those drivers who are really smooth like that are doing really well with these types of cars that generate downforce from tunnels underneath, not like last year's cars where it was a little bit different. So just one of those things to look out for, because like you can now start to tell the drivers who are very aggressive in those braking zones or who really attack and hustle the corner entries, those are the guys who are struggling at the moment.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's a really good take.
Tim, before we wrap this up, you had teased at the beginning of the podcast that you want to talk a little bit about the outcome of today's Indy 500 race, huge day for Marcus Ericsson. Seems like F1 drivers are having a big impact in North America in this series. But my friend, before we wrap this up, I want you to take it away, because I'm really eager to hear your take and your analysis from today's Indy 500.
Oh my God. So like, obviously like my background is a big part of it is in IndyCar. You know, obviously I was a part of the Renault development program back in the day for Formula One. But yeah, you know, Champ Car at the time really accepted me with open arms, and they helped me a lot get into the series. And so obviously a huge IndyCar fan. The race today was spectacular, man. Like just seeing that event, over 300,000 people in attendance, nice full grandstands, one hell of a race. The Chip Ganassi car, it was quick in a straight line. And I think for Pato, you know, speaking with him afterwards, the car wasn't like it was trimmed out as much as it could, but they're still missing some straight line speed from that Aero McLaren machinery. And I think I think Pato had that one chance to win it, but just couldn't get it done. Couldn't hold on to it. It was exciting though. You know, I'm happy. I'm happy to see a good race, and I'm happy for Marcus Ericsson. I mean, this is a guy again, like he was a little tongue in cheek, but during, you know, his media availability, he kept saying like, hey, not bad for a pay driver. So if you go back to like his time in like Formula One, right? Like, everyone always gave him a hard time. They're like, oh yeah, this pay driver coming into F1. He's a good driver. He's very good, very talented, and never really had the pieces of equipment that he needed to make himself, you know, shine. And you can say that about a lot of Formula One drivers who just never get that opportunity because the equipment's just not geared towards them. But
sure,
you know, hats off to Marcus Ericsson, man, coming over to America, learning open wheel racing over here. It is a little different. It's a little more, I don't know, barbaric, I guess you would say. It's a lot more dangerous. But working hard and finding his way, and I think working hard is like a key statement for him that defines Marcus Ericsson, because he's just a hard worker. He will never let anyone outwork him. He will be the last guy at the track. He will be the last guy in the engineering department. He will not be outworked. And I have huge, huge respect for that.
Yeah, same here. Love that.
This is a guy who won two races last year. He won in Detroit, won in Nashville, just missed another victory at Mid-Ohio. So this is his third win. I think this is second podium this year. He just missed a podium last week, but it's great to see. And Tim, I very much remember those criticisms of him being a pay driver, first with Caterham and later with Sauber. And again, that was in a very dark period for Sauber before the Alfa Romeo money came in. Mm-hmm. They were a lowly performing team, but great to see a good guy like Marcus Ericsson, who puts in the work, like you described, being successful on this side of the Atlantic.
Yeah. And then, you know, one final thing on that is that, like, this isn't an easy series. You know, like, IndyCar is hard. Like, these guys are incredible drivers. Like, Scott Dixon could come into Formula One and win championships, no problem. And he probably still could do it. Like, that's how good Scott Dixon, like, is. And these guys are, you know, all competing against each other. Like, ask Romain Grosjean just how competitive IndyCar is. Like, ask him. Like, he'll tell you. Like, he'll tell you just how hard IndyCar is to be good and to win. You know, from first place to 20th place, separated by like 5/10.
Wow. Yeah, that's incredible. When you look at it, when you break down like that gap between it, I mean, that is amazing. And when you hear like a guy like Romain Grosjean, who's obviously seen it from both sides of the coin now, that says a lot. And I mean, I don't think there's any suggestion out there like in Formula One, or sorry, maybe not just in Formula One, but in racing fandom in general, that IndyCar is an easy series. But it just goes to prove that, you know, it's tough wherever you go, whenever you get to the top of whatever series it might be.
Cool.
100%.
All right, boys, I think this was a fantastic recap of an eventful weekend at Monaco. Obviously, we got a little bit of color and a little bit of insight into what was also a spectacular day at Indy. It was great to see. Oh, Tim,
sorry,
Tim,
please. One more thing, guys. I actually want to get your thoughts on Monaco being back on the calendar for next season, and it might not be.
You know, this is like the evergreen discussion. It's like a track that I love and despise at the same time. And as often as I'd love to see it like disappear from the calendar, as soon as it goes back every year and I see the cars racing around there, oh, you know, I kind of like it after all. You know, it's got the historic thing to it. And then I don't know, I'm just so torn, you know, because I mean, it is not suited to the cars, or the cars are not suited to the track in this day and age. But, you know, I recognize like the, you know, the value that it has to Formula One. So I don't know. I mean, ask me today and I'll tell you a different thing tomorrow, right? It just depends which way the wind is blowing.
Look, we talked about this on our last podcast at length, and I went on a bit of a rant as well. And I think for some reason, I was siding with Formula One as a business entity, as if I was a shareholder in Liberty. And my point was like, look, they don't pay anything, or they don't pay a lot in terms of sanctioning fee. They get total control over the broadcast. all of the advertising on the boards and in the banners and in the stands aren't actually oftentimes Formula One sponsors at all. They're localized sponsors that are specific to the organizing or the race body here. You know what? That's not necessarily fair to Formula One, but Formula One does have something that maybe it's never had before, which is a huge amount of leverage in negotiating with the race organizers in all different cities. Like, this isn't exclusive to Monaco. This conversation isn't just happening here. It's happening in France and it's happening in Belgium. And to be perfectly honest, if Monaco dropped off the calendar for a year, I wouldn't miss it simply because there's so many other great races. Like, when we're talking about a 22 or a 23 race calendar, there's going to be some really great stuff there. And I get its historical relevance to the sport, but if I'm Formula One and my duty is to show value to my shareholders and our ownership group, if I can squeeze the race organizers in Monaco for a better deal, I'm going to do that. And we know that they're willing to negotiate in the public realm because they did that with Drive to Survive. It wasn't that long ago that Stefano Domenicali was talking about the fact that, hey, you know what, if we don't work out a new deal with Netflix, we could shop this somewhere else. And they're doing the same thing with the races now. So I'm sure that Monaco will find a way to secure its future. But I think that in doing so, Formula One, Liberty, the FIA need to have some serious conversations about what they can do to smooth out this track, to make it more compatible with the types of cars that we're seeing today. Because we saw this in Daily, we talked about this in Yas, they invested millions of dollars to reprofile a couple of major corners.
Yep.
In Australia, they invested millions of dollars to reconfigure that track. It's time. And I get it. People will say the infrastructure won't allow it. It's a city. There's sidewalks, buildings, blah, 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 blah. Figure it out. If you're going to host a Formula One race, a race in the greatest racing series on the planet, figure out a way. This isn't a right. It's a privilege to host a race, no matter how much money you're spending on it. Figure out a way to make racing better.
Yeah, well said. I totally agree with you. You know, I was speaking with Total Wolf about this on Saturday. I asked him about it and what he thought about, you know, should Monaco be on the calendar moving forward? And, you know, he had said to me that, you know, he was biased, obviously, because he spends time there. He splits his time there. But on the other hand, you know, he was very understanding of the fact that, like, hey, you know, we need to make money, right? We're a big sport now. We can't be giving things away for free. And if, like, for instance, we take a look at like Canada, right? Let's use Canada, guys, as an example. Canada pays a lot of money to bring Formula One to Montreal. Right? We pay a lot of money. And Montreal or Canadian Grand Prix is like one of those historic races, right? It's one of the ones that has to be on the calendar because of how long it's been there for, the tradition of it. And same goes for Monaco, obviously. But they're not really paying anything. So that doesn't make sense, right? It doesn't really add up. So if I am a business owner, like if I own Formula One, I wouldn't care about that tradition. I would want to see the money in return. And yes, I agree that the track needs to be reconfigured somehow. And I'm sure they can find a way because these cars are just way too big for it. They're just way too big. Like you can't fit two of these cars going down some of these streets anymore. There's no way. Yeah. They're way too big. And so, yeah, I think there needs to be some configurations to the track. Like, just figure it out, right?
Absolutely. 2 weeks from now, we are off to Baku, which is an incredibly high-speed streets track. And a week after that, Tim, Daly, I know you guys are both incredibly excited about this. 3 weeks from today, we are back in Canada for the first time in 3 years. It's going to be obviously a very special event because we're going to have two Canadians on the grid. Lance Stroll is going to return. He raced there previously in 17, 18, and 19. Nicholas Latifi has tested there in a Formula One car in the past. He's had a couple of free practice sessions, but this will be the first time that he will be on the starting grid. So for everybody listening in Canada, make sure you buckle up for this one because it's going to be incredibly exciting that for the first time, we're going to have two Canadians competing in a Formula One race in Canada. With that, gentlemen, thank you so much for joining. Tim, we're hoping, fingers crossed, you'll be able to join us once again or rejoin you
for 2 weeks
from now when we recap what should be a spectacular race in Baku, because those races have always been a little bit exciting and there's often been some really, really great surprises. So with that, thanks everybody for listening. If you want to tune in, you can obviously follow the Scuderia F1 Pod at Scuderia F1 Pod on Twitter, on Instagram. You can follow Mark Daly at Mark Daly F1 on Twitter. You can follow myself at Mark in Van City. Tim, if people are looking to follow you, connect with your podcast, if they haven't already, where can they get connect with you?
Absolutely. Thanks, Mark. At Tim Hauraney on all forums of social media, H-A-U-R-A-N-E-Y. It's a hard one to spell. And also, yeah, TSN Racing Pod. You can get that wherever you get your podcasts, or head to tsn.ca/tsn-racing-pod to stream it. We'll have some pretty exciting content coming out in lead up to the Canadian Grand Prix. We're going to be blowing that up pretty big on SportsCenter and for TSN the week leading into the Canadian Grand Prix. So super excited for that, guys. Like, I'm really looking forward to it. The sport is massive in Canada now. It's one of the biggest at the moment viewed on television. So yeah, I've been working at this for quite a few years, and at times it's felt like pushing water uphill, but I am super stoked just to see how big this sport is becoming here. It's great. Awesome. It's great.
Yeah.
My friend, and nobody deserves more than you to be there and to relish the atmosphere and the excitement of a renewed Canadian Grand Prix. We look forward to it. Cannot wait to see you there. Cannot wait to hear your bites and all of the great insights and interviews you're able to pick up. With that, everyone, thank you so much. We will see you again on our podcast. The State of the Air F1 podcast is coming Thursday. We will be joined by Tim, or we will join Tim 2 weeks from now when we recap the Azerbaijan Grand Prix from Baku. Until then, thanks for joining us. Bye, everybody.